Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. I'm real excited about tonight's show. We have Dr. Jacques Vallée on for the first half hour, and we have a gentleman named Alan Stivelman coming on after that. We're going to be talking about a film that was made about a very important Argentinian case, and the name of the movie that's coming out on October 22nd is called Witness of Another World. And I have watched it myself, and it's a great movie. Now, as far as our guest, Jacques Vallée, probably doesn't need much of an introduction in the UFO world. I would have to say this, that for all the guests I could ever have on this show, I would say that he is the number one guest that I'm excited about having on. So welcome to the show, Jacques.
Thank you. I'm humbled by that introduction. Sometimes I joke that I'm the only ufologist who doesn't know what UFOs are, because I've studied, as you know, a lot of cases going back to working with Dr. Hynek, of course, and also working with people in France and in Europe. I don't have a favorite explanation. Obviously, the outer space extraterrestrial explanation is always a possibility. It's always there. But I've occasionally made enemies by pointing out there were other things that the phenomenon did that didn't match any hypothesis we have yet, which is where science takes over. I mean, that's why it's interesting.
I think that's true. I remember when we met in Phoenix, we were in line together at the hotel, and I said to you something along the lines that I've been doing my show for a number of years now, and I know less than I did about UFOs than when I started. It just seems like it's such a mystery, and I really like that you don't have any one explanation. And that's kind of the benefit of doing this show, is hearing people's ideas, because that's really all they are at this point, is just ideas.
Well, we see new ideas, fortunately, but we also see new pieces of data, new phenomena that are being uncovered as more and more people become involved. And that's, that's how research functions.
Right, right. For now, you had a sighting very early on in your life over in France. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and just kind of give? Go ahead.
This was the year after a major wave over Western Europe in 1954. I was about 16 at the time. This was during the summer vacation. Very clear afternoon. Sunday afternoon, I was helping my father with some work inside the house, and my mother was in the yard tending to the yard, and she saw it first and called us, and I rushed out and I saw essentially a disc that was something like half a mile away, I would estimate, close to, and I had a reference as a church needle, that was very, very clearly about half a mile away, and the object seemed to be in that vicinity above the church. The next day, I spoke to a friend of mine from school who lived another half mile up the hill from me. He had seen the same thing and had looked at it with binoculars, so he had three witnesses. It looked like a shiny disc with a dome on top, pretty much what Wow. so many people have described. And at the time, we didn't report it. There was no real place to report it. And we thought that it might be a prototype of something that would eventually become known. And of course, that never happened. There is no such craft in existence flying around today.
Right, right. That's one of the arguments you hear a lot, as far as people will talk today about seeing, for instance, the Nimitz UFO case, the Tic Tac UFO. People will say, well, that's military. But these things have been having this same type of behavior, you know, going way back, as you know. And, you know, that's one of the arguments you never hear too many people talk about, is that, you know, these strange craft doing unbelievable things have been around for a long time. And, you know, one of the things you hear about the most, or I don't want to say the most, but you do hear a lot of, is the triangle UFOs. And there's,
yes,
you know, there's cases that go way back. I just spoke to someone recently that back in the 1970s saw a triangle. You know, it was her words, not mine, you know, so they, it's not like they're a new model that comes out, but the disc sure seemed like most people were seeing back in the day.
Well, I know, you know, you're going to be speaking with Alan Silverman about that movie that was done in about a case in Argentina. That's what is so unique about that case, is that there is no, you know, it's not military. It doesn't have to do with, you know, the CIA or a cover-up or an aircraft carrier or the Pentagon or any of that that we like to talk about, you know, in the U.S. It's a case of a young boy, 12-year-old boy, on an isolated farm in a very flat, nondescript part of the country, suddenly being confronted with something completely extraordinary, and there is no explanation. I mean, this was not military, this was not a hoax, this was not any of that, and we were able to document the circumstances extremely well. And what is unique in the whole history of the phenomenon is that we were able to document his life, document what happened to him in the rest of his life.
Right.
And including things that continued, phenomena that continued when he was an adult.
Right. Now, in the area that Juan was located, it most likely he had never even heard of any type of situation like that.
At the time, no. And I had met people from Argentina at a conference, actually, in Mexico. And they had invited me to lecture in five cities in Argentina. And they said, by the way, you have to lecture in Spanish, which sent me back to my books and made me, relearn enough Spanish so that I could do, you know, a reasonable job of presenting the phenomenon. But then I said, if I do that, I want to spend one extra day, have a free day after each lecture in every, as you know, Argentina is a very large country. Mm. It's the size of Western Europe. And there were these five different regions were very different. And they agreed to let me meet local investigators, UFO investigators, in those different provinces, spending an extra day everywhere before we moved to the next city. And that was extraordinary because, of course, I was exposed to a lot of different phenomena, a lot of different cases that they had already investigated, and this was one of them. And this was in the north of Argentina, in a province called Entre Rios, between the rivers, which is really it's purely an agricultural area. It's very flat. And this happened on an isolated farmhouse, isolated estancia, where this young boy was charged with taking care of the horses. And in the morning, he had to round up the herd and bring them close to the farmhouse to feed them and so on. And as he went out, there was a lot of fog over the land, and in the fog was this extraordinary object. Now, I met him 2 years after his experience, so by the time I met him, he was 14. My wife was with me, and my wife was French. She was a child psychologist, and also the school teacher from the school where the child went was with the family. They gathered everybody, so the investigators were there, the family. I met his father, his mother, his siblings, and the school teacher. And my wife had a conversation with the school teacher, and the child was a good student. He wasn't the best student in the class, but he was, you know, very serious, very applied, didn't lie, didn't make up stories. And by the way, when you met his father, who was a true gaucho, that was pretty clear that you wouldn't joke around his father.
Mm. I know there's a part in the movie where he is, I think he actually goes to some type of conference or meeting or something like that, and it comes time for him to tell his story, and he just gets super emotional and he just can't do it.
He just breaks down, yes. The whole movie shows,
yes.
That's what I know is very powerful, because it shows something that, you know, we don't talk about very much in the literature, but the impact on the witness, that this is something that's completely outside their reality. And by the way, it's outside our reality, our everyday reality. And I know just what I saw when I was, you know, when I was a kid has stayed with me all my life. It probably motivated me to get into this kind of research. And I know many people who were motivated the same way. And here, Alan contacted me. Alan is a young, you know, a young filmmaker, an artist in Argentina. He contacted me 3 years ago, saying he had was working on some other ideas and had met this man who by then was in his late 40s up in an isolated shack, essentially a cabin up north in Argentina, living essentially alone with his animals, very close to nature, very poor, hiring himself out to local landowners and local farmers to work around the farm. And he had this incredible story, and it was a story that I had published a summary of it in one of my books, in a book called Revelations. And Alan wanted to come to San Francisco and interview me about, you know, what it was like when I met the family and I met this teenager who had that experience. And I said, well, Alan, do you know about the other cases the same week in the same town? And he said, what other cases? Well, there were 3 other cases by adults, young adults, in the same town of Venado Tuerto, and that I had documented in my report. And I said, well, let's do 2 things. First, I'm going to send you my file, the whole file, which was about 20 or 25 pages, including photographs I had taken at the time and my interview of everybody there. And then I said, if I could come to Buenos Aires, we could close the circle with him. And maybe the encounter with me coming back from his past would help reunite the family, because by then he was ostracized, he was pushed back by the family because his experience was so strange. And also, you know, help him sort of close the circle in his own mind, and it will also help me, because this was very emotional to me. And you'll see that in the movie. You know, I'm not a movie actor, and you can see that I was very, very moved in meeting him again and in revisiting the family. And I think we did a great job of helping him. And I think what you see in the movie is his transformation,
yes,
from, you know, being hunted by this phenomenon, which is still around him, and then emerging from it with much more confidence and so on. And that's really what the movie is all about.
Right. And this dramatic situation that he had at such a young age, you know, I imagine in some ways rather stunted him. And, you know, he becomes emotional quite a few times during the movie, but you're right, you can see a transformation. And I really like when the story focuses on the people. And I think Alan did a very nice job with that. I'd like to quote or paraphrase, because I don't know it exactly, but there was a line you said during this movie, such as, we see things as kind of a display, an exhibition of images back from like your background of subconscious. That's one of the thoughts you have on what people are seeing. Would you mind explaining that just a little bit?
Yes. Well, you know the book by Dr. Salisbury in Utah, who has done so much. Professor Salisbury wrote a book about the sightings in northern Utah, and he was, of course, a professor of biology at Utah State, and that at the University of Utah, who did really the first very thorough assessment of the sightings there, including the area of the famous ranch, by the way. And his book was called The Utah UFO Display, because the people that he interviewed, both the, you know, people from the Mormon population and the Indian population in Utah, were describing something that wasn't so much mechanical. You know, we like to think in terms of technology, like, you know, around the Nimitz and so on. But those things can really display themselves in a whole variety of different things, as if they could paint an image of themselves, and they can look technological one moment and then turn into just a ball of light that goes through a wall. Mm-hmm. And this is not any technology we have, okay? This is that idea of the display is very important, and you have to go beyond the obvious technological interpretations. And before I went to, so Alan agreed to that I could come to Argentina instead of his coming to San Francisco, and I spent about 10 days there. But before I went there, I relearned enough Spanish so that I could speak one-on-one. Yes. With Juan. And you'll see that in the movie, there are parts where it's just the two of us together, because I didn't want to get into that aspect of it with an interpreter. I wanted to hear his own words, and I wanted to speak with him in his own language, because it's just so, you know, so important. And I think that helped us also in closing that circle, that I was, you know, I wanted to be really close, following his emotions. And, you know, I don't cry as easily as he does, but then I haven't had that kind of experience. And but it was obviously very emotional for me as well.
Right, right. Yes, I was actually pretty impressed with your Spanish. You did pretty well. And I will tell the listener that watching the movie, don't feel it's a hindrance to have this movie in Spanish, because there is some Spanish with subtitles, but the majority of the movie is actually in English. And it's very easy to follow all the way through. And some interesting people. Did you re-meet any of the people besides Juan when you were there, that you had met before?
Well, I was delighted to meet his family again. Ah, and mm-hmm. It was wonderful to help. That's not in the movie, but to help reunite him, in a way, emotionally, with his family. Because the fact that we were there filming his experience, and the fact that I came back, and they remembered me, his father and his mother are still alive. Of course, his siblings are now, you know, older. They are adults. So it helped reconnect, in a way, reconnect the family. And I could afford to joke with his father, and it was wonderful. It was joyful. You know, just to give you an anecdote, and again, it's not in the movie, but that's part of the human experience. His father has a felt hat, you know, like not exactly a cowboy hat, but a gaucho hat. Mm-hmm. And I had a picture. I had brought my pictures of the days when I was there, you know, 35 years before, and he had a hat, the same hat. So I told him, Signore, es el mismo sombrero, you know, it's the same hat. And he laughed. And, you know, it was just so nice, you know, that he laughed because it was the same hat. And those are the little things, you know, that you have to spend the time. You have to. And so often in the U.S., you know, when there is an investigation done, a couple of investigators go there, and they go there with a questionnaire, and they fill out the questionnaire with the witness, and it's all very abstract and scientific and logical. But those experiences are not logical. They are not. You have to deal with the emotion. You have to deal with, and then they never go back. And here, what's unique about this is that we have this extended time. And we have the testimony from different people at different times of his life over 40 years. And that is a unique piece of testimony about the whole phenomenon.
Do you think that he would have a total different life if this didn't happen? I mean, like you mentioned, he's in a very remote area in this cabin, and it looks like, you know, he hunts and everything, you know, for food and has his animals and gardens and things like that. Do you think, I noticed at the end, he seemed to really enjoy being around, you know, family and in the village at the very end of the movie.
There is no question. He felt estranged from his family. And, you know, so many witnesses go through that, so many witnesses of close encounters. I remember working with Dr. Hynek and interviewing some of the highway patrol people in the Midwest who had encounters and abductions, and being unable to stay in the police force and having to resign. Lonnie Zamora in Socorro. Right. Had that experience, being ostracized because he was different. You know, he was a guy who had seen the flying saucer, and professionally that ruined his experience. And many of these people went through divorces. Their neighbors would throw stones at their house. I mean, they would be rejected as, you know, the guy who has done something a little strange and brought disrepute to the family or to the town. I've seen that with so many witnesses, you know, both in Europe, in France, but also in, certainly in the U.S. And that's an aspect of it that nobody has looked at.
Right.
And the first thing that I have to do when I go to a site and is deal with the human situation before you pull out the questionnaire and, you know, the compass and the cameras and so on. You have to deal with the people as human beings. And very often they are hurt. They are hurt in their family. They are hurt in their friendships and in their professions.
Right. Yes. I remember watching some video, some documentary that had taken place in either the early 60s or late 1950s. And there were people talking about their experiences back then. And I remember there was a man that said, if one landed right beside me, I wouldn't tell a soul after what I've gone through. So you're
and,
right.
Well, especially in the military, you know, there was an experience in Minnesota in Minot, the famous Minot case of a B-52 that had an object both on radar and visually, and one member of the crew went to the back of the aircraft in order not to see it, and his buddy said, "Why don't you want to look at it?" And he said, "Well, I'm interviewing with an airline next week. I don't want to have to say that I've seen a flying saucer."
Wow, isn't that
amazing?
He
did not want to see it.
Yeah, Yes.
So the penalties in some of those in the military and in the police force, the penalty for seeing something that's unexplained can be drastic.
And what do you think about now? Do you think things have changed ever since I mentioned earlier, ever since the article came out in the New York Times, people seem to be more acceptable? And I just wanted to get your take on that. I know you have to go in a couple of minutes here, but
I'm okay. Let's wait for Alan. I'd like to say hi to him. We've become close friends. I wish I could say yes, things have changed. I'm not so sure. I can tell you things have not changed very much in the scientific community. People are afraid for their reputation. They are afraid for their grants, for their budget. Just almost as much today as they did. There isn't the same stigma, but people still look at you funny. Mm-hmm. Not so much in Silicon Valley, because Silicon Valley is so strange anyway, in many other ways, but in the scientific community in general. And I think that's still true in the military. And I think maybe the Nimitz experience, we've changed things, because so many of these pilots were highly respected and everybody knows they're not lying.
That's right. Yes. I think that's made such headway. And, David Fravor, some people have said a couple things lately since he was on Joe Rogan recently. But I think I think there's absolutely no doubt about the quality of the witness that he is. And yeah. I think it has definitely made a difference. And I would say that's myself. I'd say that's one of the top cases just because of what has happened with that. It just seems to have moved things forward a bit. And I don't know if you've probably seen things move forward many times in your long career looking into this. And do you have hopes? I don't think there's going to be a disclosure, so to say, but it just seems more acceptable.
What in a way is ironic is the UFO community has said this is great progress because the Navy has requested more testimony, and they are reinstating the reporting. Well, I remember the days working with Dr. Hynek on the Project Blue Book files. There were hundreds of reports from the Navy. The Navy had a reporting sequence, reporting regulation that was parallel to JANAP and to the other regulations of the Air Force, and they were reporting into Project Blue Book. The Air Force was the point of contact for all the armed forces. And so I remember going through a number of cases from the Navy when I built the database for Project Blue Book. And then they closed down Project Blue Book, and the Navy went its own way, not gathering those cases anymore. And now they are reinstating the same protocol. That doesn't mean necessarily a recognition of that these things are unexplained. It means a recognition that we want to track, or they want to track, those things. It also means they are not going to be made public. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a reverse of what the UFO community is expecting.
Absolutely. Guess what? We have Alan on the line. Alan Silverman, welcome to the show.
Hey, Martin. Thanks for having me. Hey, Shaq. Good afternoon.
Hey, ¿cómo estás?
Muy bien, ¿y tú?
Bastante bien. It's muy frío aquí in San Francisco.
Yeah, let's just do the rest of the show in Spanish.
That will be fun. That will be fun.
Either Spanish or French.
Lost on both.
I will let you talk to Alan. I know you're eager to talk to him and get his side of the story.
Well, Jacques, I'll tell you, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it because I've been told today that you don't go on too many shows, and it's just I feel really honored, and thank you so much.
Well, this movie is exceptional. So.
Yes. All right.
Hey, thank you very much.
All right. You take care.
Thank you, Jack.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All right, Alan. All right. So let me let's see. So you are a filmmaker, and I think, you know, watching this film, I was saying I think it was a very good film, and I was really glad that when Jacques, you contacted him, and he said, sure, you know, he got involved right away, which is, that must have been really exciting for you.
It was, indeed. I was shooting, but that time, I think it was in the middle of the shooting of this movie, and then I got this idea to write him and send him, like, a letter telling him about what we were doing with this film, what was the, like, the message behind this story of Juan Perez. And I also told him that Juan was not doing good. He was feeling really lonely after the encounter that he had when he was 12. He got some, like, gifts or curse because he felt that the premonition dreams that he had, it was more like a curse instead of a gift. And he was really suffering because of these consequences that he had. He also received mockery from his family, from his relatives, his friends. And I didn't know that he will remember this case because Jack only mentioned in two of his books, in Forbidden Science and in Confrontations. But, you know, Jack, he read thousands and thousands of cases around the globe. But I just gave that shot, and I asked him to go to San Francisco and do this interview. Jack is a very low-profile person, so I didn't want to interrupt his project. I just want to have his opinion about the case, and that's it. And he gave me the idea to go to Argentina, to stay with Juan, to try to help him. And for me, it was one of the most important gifts in my life. And the movie changed completely when he appeared. So it was a truly pleasure to have him on board.
Yeah, I totally get that. It must have been quite amazing. All right, everyone, that's it for the first part of the show. Feel free to help us out and get to listen to the full shows for only $2 or more per month. All that information's on podcastufo.com. You can also subscribe for the yearly podcast, which is as low as $15 per year, and get to listen to the whole shows on your media player. You can also log into the website and listen. If you can't do that and you want to listen to the full shows, you can always listen live. And that's every Tuesday nights at 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on our website or on YouTube. You can also listen over at KGRA Radio and over on Thursday nights at the Dark Matter Digital Network. And that's it. Next week, we have Dr. Seth Shostak from the SETI Institute. He'll be on in the second hour. I'm not sure who's going to be on the first hour at this point. But if you'd like to find out who's going to be on our shows, you can go over to podcastufo.com and sign up. On the right-hand side, there is a mailing list that you can sign up to get the newsletters. And also, while you're there, check out our blog. That is by Charles Lear, and it's called Chilean UFOs. Thanks so much, and remember to keep your eyes to the sky.